The Roman Colosseum. When we think of ancient Rome, we think of Caesars, gladiators, lions and Christians, thumbs up, thumbs down, and of the Colosseum, Rome's most enduring monument. Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for joining me as we tour the Colosseum inside and out. We'll stand where the emperors did, catch the view from the nosebleed seats, and get a peek backstage at the gladiator games where trained warriors squared off mano-a-mano in a battle to the death. Be aware that there are often long lines to buy tickets to the Colosseum, so consult a guidebook about how to maximize your sightseeing time. For our tour, allow about an hour to see the Colosseum and experience the grandeur that was Rome. How to use this audio guide. As you can see from the display window on your MP3 player, each of our stops in the Colosseum has its own title and track number, much like the song tracks of a music CD. You can skip ahead or tailor your itinerary to your own tastes. But navigating through the Colosseum can be a bit confusing, and it's easiest to just follow the tour in the order I've laid out. To help you along, I've invited my colleague, Lisa Brown. Welcome, Lisa.
Buongiorno.
She'll give directions from one exhibit to the next. After listening to her directions, you can pause the audio guide, then restart it at the next track when you're ready to see the next sight. Be aware that even with the best directions, sightseeing the Colosseum can be confusing. Entrances, exits, and passageways can be rerouted, and entire areas can be closed off for restoration. If you're taking this tour with my Rick Steves Audio Europe app, don't miss its latest features. There are zoomable maps showing the route and each stop. These are viewable while you listen. A 20-second rewind button allows you to catch something you might have missed or hear vital directions a second time. And the speed button makes me talk faster, chipmunk style. You can read the actual script of this tour, and if you'd like more information on the spot, you can download our entire guidebook on this destination with a couple of clicks. Those following this tour on their iPod rather than with my fancier app may find that my guidebook to this place, with its maps, photos, and exhibit titles, can make following this audio tour easier. Now, let's explore the Colosseum. Lisa, start us off.
Thanks, Rick.
The tour begins. The Colosseum exterior.
Get a good view of the Colosseum from the outside. A good place to start is across the street from the Colosseo metro station. From here, you can see the imposing Colosseum and the triumphal arch of Constantine that stands alongside. The area outside the Colosseum is usually a mob scene of tourists, souvenir hawkers, pickpockets, and goofy guys dressed like gladiators. If the line to get into the Colosseum is long, consider getting in line now while Rick describes the exterior. Otherwise, just find a spot with a good view, face the Colosseum, and take it all in. Rick?
Built when the Roman Empire was at its peak in 80 AD, the Colosseum represents Rome at its grandest. Its real name was the Flavian Amphitheater, an arena for gladiator contests and public spectacles. When killing became a spectator sport, the Romans wanted to share the fun with as many people as possible. So they stuck two semicircular theaters together to create a freestanding amphitheater, the biggest in the empire. The sheer size of the Colosseum is impressive, even in our era of domed stadiums. With four oversized stories, it's 160 feet high, nearly a third of a mile around, and it makes an oval-shaped footprint that covers 6 acres. Imagine the Colosseum in its glory days. The whole thing was a brilliant white, highlighted with brightly painted trim. Monumental statues of Greek and Roman gods, also painted in bright colors, stood in the arches of the two middle stories, Zeus, Venus, Hercules. The top of the structure was studded with wooden beams sticking straight up, designed to hold an awning that shaded the spectators inside. The stadium could accommodate 50,000 roaring fans. That's 100,000 thumbs. As Romans arrived for the games, they'd be greeted outside by a huge bronze statue of the Emperor Nero, 100 feet tall, gleaming in the sunlight, standing where the cypress trees stand today, between the Colosseum and the metro stop. Though the Colosseum is massive, it looks light and airy. The three lower stories are nothing but open arches framed by half columns. The arches are stacked right on top of each other, and all the columns line up as well, drawing your eye upward. Meanwhile, each story forms a horizontal band that wraps all around the structure. This combination of horizontal and vertical lines makes the Colosseum appear firmly planted on the ground while reaching for the sky. By the way, feel free to wander around and take in the Colosseum from different angles. You'll notice that only about a third of the original Colosseum remains. The north side, closest to the metro station, is the best preserved, with the top story still intact. But the more damaged south side gives a better look at the structural elements. The Colosseum's facade says a lot about the Roman personality. The Romans were great engineers, not artists, and the decoration is borrowed from the more sophisticated Greeks. Look closely at the half columns that flank the arches. These columns have no structural purpose. They're just window dressing, done in the Greek style. At ground level, you'll see thick columns with simple capitals. That's the top part of the column. Moving up to the next story, the columns are thinner, with scroll-shaped capitals. On the third story, you'll find leafy capitals, and the top level has a fanciful mix of all three styles. These are the three so-called orders of classical Greece: sturdy Doric on the bottom, scroll-shaped Ionic, and leafy Corinthian. By combining these three classy Greek elements with pragmatic Roman engineering, it added a veneer of sophistication to this no-nonsense arena of death. Of the 250 or so amphitheaters in the Roman Empire, the Colosseum was the granddaddy of them all, the biggest and most famous, with all the top-notch gladiators. Out-of-town visitors would marvel at it, the biggest man-made structure they'd ever seen. Over time, the Flavian Amphitheater acquired a nickname, perhaps from the colossal statue of Nero that stood outside, or maybe just because the building itself was so darn colossal, the wonder of its age. It became the Colosseum.
Now, let's head for the entrance and get ready to go inside. Wade through the crowds. Be a bit cautious with the goofy gladiators. They're charming when they pose for photos, but establish the price ahead of time, or they'll try to overcharge you.
And they've got swords.
When you're ready to enter, make sure you get in the right line. There are usually separate queues for ticket buyers, for those who already have a ticket or pass, for groups, and so on. All right, let's go in. As you shuffle into the Colosseum, it'll take some time. So listen to the next track as Rick and I guide you in.
Entering the Colosseum.
As you make your way in, our goal is to get to the open-air arena. That's where the gladiator games took place and where most of our sightseeing tour is. Before you get there, you have to pass through a security check, then through the interior concourses, then have your ticket checked at the turnstile. After the turnstile, the crowd is routed into the arena itself. This process can take as little as a few minutes if you have an advance ticket, or an hour or more with crowds and ticket buying. Be patient. As you shuffle along, listen while Rick talks about how the Colosseum was built.
The Colosseum was started around 72 AD under the emperors of the Flavian family. Vespasian broke ground on it, his son Titus inaugurated it, and his younger son Domitian finished it. It took less than 10 years, which is impressive considering the size of the project. To start, they had to drain a lake here in this valley between three hills. Next, they sunk concrete foundations 40 feet deep. Then they brought the stone here from Tivoli, 200 ox-drawn wagons shuttling back and forth every day for 4 years. The exterior is a skeleton made of heavy blocks of travertine, a hard white stone like marble. The Romans pioneered the use of the rounded arch, which is how they could build on this tremendous scale. Well, having unlimited slave power didn't hurt either. Look at the arches on the ground level, made out of travertine blocks. Workers erected temporary scaffolding out of wood into the shape of an arch, Then they stacked the blocks without using mortar. When they got near the top, they wedged an inverted stone, the keystone, into the peak of the arch. Then, when they removed the scaffolding, bravissimo! Not only didn't the arch collapse, it could bear even more weight above it.
Excuse me, Rick, but just a reminder to our listeners that we're headed through security, then to the ticket turnstiles, and then into the open-air arena. Don't worry, you'll get there. It's where all the crowds are headed.
As you walk through the concourses, check out the massive pillars that formed the exterior frame of the structure. Notice the holes that pockmark the exterior. This is where big iron brackets were once driven in, stapling the larger stones together. Each of the pillars flanking the ground-level arches weighs 5 tons, and all in all, they used 3.5 million cubic feet of travertine. When it was finished, the Colosseum made a political statement. It trumpeted Rome's victory over rebellious Jews in Palestine in 70 AD. Booty and slaves from that campaign helped build the place. Also, having been erected on the former site of Emperor Nero's Golden House, the Colosseum symbolized how that hated emperor's private land was now reclaimed for the public good. The Colosseum is a marvel of engineering, ingeniously playing one architectural force off another. It's a testament to how the enlightened Romans could conquer their barbarian neighbors not just by brute military force, but by brain power. Like many structures built by the pragmatic Romans, the Colosseum is more functional than beautiful. They loved good engineering. If ancient Romans visited the United States today as tourists, they might send home postcards of our greatest works of art, freeways. Fans could pour in through 80 ground-level entrances, including the emperor's private entrance on the north side. Your ticket was a piece of broken pottery telling you the entrance, section, row, and seat number. You'd pass by concession stands selling fast food and souvenirs like wine glasses with the names of famous gladiators. The hallways to the seats were called by the Latin word, vomitorium. At exit time, the Colosseum would literally vomit out its contents, giving us our English word. It's estimated that all 50,000 fans could enter or exit in 15 minutes.
Of course, that was before metal detectors. You eventually reach the turnstiles where they check your ticket. From here, tourists are sometimes forced to follow a specific visitor route. If so, no worries. Just follow the flow of crowds until you emerge into the arena. You might end up entering the arena here at street level, or you may be routed upstairs to the upper seating areas. You may pass museum exhibits showing archaeological finds from the area. But don't worry, whichever route you take, the crowds all eventually spill out into the open air with staggering views of the arena. Wherever you're at, ground level, upper level, north side, south side, it doesn't matter. Our tour works well from any spot in the Colosseum.
And there wasn't a bad seat in the house.
So however you get there, find a spot where you can take in the entire arena. That's where our next track begins. If you're not there yet, pause the audio guide and restart it once you're there.
The view of the arena. Take in the staggering expanse. To our modern eyes, it's immediately obvious what this place was. It's a sports stadium. There's the playing field. It's oval-shaped. And surrounding it are bleacher seats that slant up from the arena floor. 50,000 fans looked down on the playing surface, shaped like an ellipse and lined up on an east-west axis. The arena is big, not quite long enough or wide enough to play modern football or soccer on, but close. Overhead, the entire stadium could be covered with an enormous canvas awning that was hoisted across by armies of sailors to provide shade for spectators. The first dome stadium. If you're having trouble picturing the playing surface itself, that's because the original arena floor is missing. What we see today are the underground passages beneath the playing surface. More on that a bit later. Originally, the arena was covered with boards and then sprinkled with sand, 9 inches deep. In fact, the Latin word for sand is arena. Looking back down, the elliptical-shaped arena is 280 feet long and 165 feet wide. The ratio of length to width is 5:3, often called the golden ratio. Since the days of the Greek mathematician Pythagoras, artists considered that proportion to be ideal, with almost mystical properties. The Colosseum's architects apparently wanted their structure to embody the perfect 3x5 mathematical order they thought existed in nature. Looking into the complex web of passageways beneath the arena, you can imagine how busy the backstage action was. Gladiators strolled down the central passageway from their warm-up yard on the east end to where they entered on the west. Workers tended wild animals, while others prepared stage sets of fake buildings or trees that could transform the arena from, say, an African jungle to a Greek temple in an instant. These were lifted up to arena level on 80 different elevators fitted with a system of ropes and pulleys. You might be able to make out some small rectangular elevator shafts, especially near the center of the arena. Animals, warriors, and stage sets could all be made to magically appear from 80 different spots in the arena. As you enjoy this view of the arena, let's get oriented to some major landmarks. First, find the bronze cross. The cross stands on ground level, at the edge of the oval-shaped arena. It's at about what would have been the 50-yard line. See it? That cross, erected in recent centuries to honor martyrs, marks the north side of the stadium. It's thought by some scholars that the cross stands right where the emperor's box would have been. He obviously had the best seat in the house for watching the games. Oh, the games are about to begin. The trumpets blare, the drums would pound, and the gladiators enter the arena. They entered from the west end. Remember, the cross stands on the north side. They'd parade around to the music and pause at the south side. There they'd acknowledge the Vestal Virgin sitting in their special box seats on the 50-yard line. The Vestal Virgins, the 9 young ladies who tended the sacred flame of Rome, were honored there. They got season tickets as a reward for their unique contribution to Roman society, chastity. After a nod to the virgins, the gladiators continued on. The parade finally ended up at the emperor's box. There, they'd raise their weapons, salute, and shout, Ave Cesare!
Ave Cesare! Hail Caesar! We who are about to die salute you!
Though some scholars doubt whether they actually said that.
Oh.
But it is in the historical record at least once.
Yay!
Hooray!
So let's say they'd shout, Ave Cesare!
Ave Cesare!
And the games would begin. Go for it, boys!
Yeah!
The games pitted animals against animals, men against animals, and, in the main event, professional warriors called gladiators squaring off in mortal combat. The battles were bloody, gruesome, and cruel, and ended with at least one of the combatants dead. Imagine the scene from the gladiator's point of view. Imagine standing in the middle of the arena and looking up at 50,000 screaming people. Imagine they all hate you, and they want to see you die.
Ooh, I wonder if gladiators got stage fright. With thrilling scenes like this in mind, let's start exploring the Colosseum.
Wander around. The next 10 minutes or so of this audio tour is just for browsing. The information can be enjoyed from any place in the arena. It doesn't matter whether you're upstairs in the cheap seats, or downstairs, schmoozing with the emperor, or flirting with the Vestal Virgins.
They took a vow, Rick.
Just stroll around and take in the views from all angles.
Eventually, you'll want to reach one particular spot, the upper level on the west end. But that's later. For now, just wander around. Start by gazing down at the playing surface. Mentally cover the underground passageways with boards and sand. Look around and imagine the gladiator games.
The Gladiator Games. The games began in the morning with a few warm-up acts. First came the animals. Things like watching dogs bloody themselves attacking porcupines. Or you'd see hunters prowling through fake forests in search of prey. Or wild animals were sicked on exotic human animals, like dark-skinned chieftains captured from so-called barbarian lands. The Colosseum's menagerie of beasts came from all over the empire and were a sight in themselves. Lions, tigers, and bears.
Oh, my!
Crocodiles, elephants, rhinos, and hippos.
Hippos?
Yes. Now, scram. The animals were kept in cages beneath the arena floor. Looking down, you can see the maze of passageways. This basement was like the backstage for the games. Here, workers prepared the animals, gladiators warmed up, and prisoners said their final prayers. It's also where stagehands readied the scenery, weapons, and props for the elaborate spectacles. At just the right moment, workers down below would hoist an animal up in an elevator through a trap door in the arena floor. The animal would pop out from behind a blind into the arena. The hunter didn't know where, when, or by what he'd be attacked. This brought howls of laughter from the hardened fans up in the cheap seats. Nets ringed the arena to protect the crowd. At lunchtime came Act Two. This is when criminals and POWs were executed, often in creative ways. They might be thrown to the lions, naked and unarmed. Or they were dressed up like classical heroes and forced to star in a play featuring their own death. To set the scene, the arena would be decorated with fake scenery, buildings, or foliage brought up from the passages below. Then the star wandered on stage, dressed as, say, Hercules or Adonis. There he was attacked by wild animals or by gladiators in costume. They'd kill him in the same way the legendary hero died. Between rounds, fans were treated to palate-cleansing gimmicks, like female gladiators fighting each other, or a dwarf battling a one-legged man. Clowns, jugglers, and circus performers provided more comic relief. Finally, in the afternoon, came the main event, the gladiators. These warriors had their own martial specialties. Some carried swords, protected only with a shield and a heavy helmet. Some threw the javelin. Others represented fighting fishermen, with a net to snare their opponents and a trident to spear them. If a gladiator fell helpless to the ground, his opponent would approach the emperor's box and ask, should he live or should he die? Sometimes the emperor or master of ceremonies left the decision to the crowd, who would judge based on how valiantly the man had fought. They would make the decision, thumbs up or thumbs down. Scholars, however, debate exactly what gesture meant what. The Romans thought nothing of condemning a coward to the death he deserved. After a gladiator was killed, a man dressed up like Charon, the grim reaper of Roman mythology, entered the arena and dragged the lifeless body away. The Colosseum was inaugurated in 80 AD with a 100-day festival. During this big party, 2,000 men and 9,000 animals were killed. That's roughly one death every 5 minutes. Colosseum employees squirted perfumes around the stadium to mask the stench of all that blood.
Wow, that's one intense sporting event.
Yeah, almost as bad as hockey.
It makes you wonder how such an advanced society could be so bloodthirsty.
I've got some theories.
I'm sure you do. So let's keep exploring the Colosseum while Rick tells us more about the games and the society that enjoyed them.
Bread and circuses. As the top arena in the empire, the Colosseum was the big time for any aspiring gladiator. Gladiators were usually from the lowest classes, slaves, criminals, prisoners of war, or the poor. They battled their way up the ranks, fighting for their freedom or for wealth and fame in the ring. They honed their technique in training schools. The empire's largest such school was just outside the Colosseum's east end. Each gladiator specialized in a particular weapon, including the sword called the gladius, which gave them their name. The best gladiators were rewarded, like our modern sports stars, with fan clubs, great wealth, groupies, and yes, product endorsements. The games were extremely popular, and surviving graffiti shows that top-notch gladiators were Rome's biggest celebrities. To modernize, the games may seem barbaric, but it suited Roman society. Rome was a nation of warriors that built an empire by conquest. Consider the value of these games in placating and controlling the huge Roman populace. On an everyday basis, city slicker bureaucrats could come here and personally witness the conquest that generated their wealth. Seeing the king of beasts, a lion, slain by a gladiator, reminded the masses of man's triumph over nature. Seeing exotic animals from Africa celebrated their conquest of distant lands. The bloody battles fought against Germans, Egyptians, and other barbarians were played out daily right here. And having the thumbs-up or thumbs-down authority over another person's life gave them a real sense of power. Imagine the psychological boost the otherwise downtrodden masses felt when the emperor granted them this thrilling decision. The gladiator games were always free, sponsored by the wealthy to bribe the people's favor and to keep Rome's growing masses of unemployed rabble off the streets. And this social policy, known as bread and circuses, actually worked. And did they really throw Christians to the lions like in the movies? In Roman times, Christians were definitely thrown to the lions, made to fight gladiators, crucified, and burned alive. But probably not here in this particular stadium. Maybe, but probably not.
Eventually, our tour will end up on the upper level at the west end. If you're on street level, you'll want to start climbing the stairs. Once on the upper level, start making your way to the west end. If you need to get your bearings, remember that north is where the Bronze Cross is. As you walk...
Or roam.
Thanks, Rick. As you roam, look around at the variety of materials used to build this stadium. Bricks, stone blocks, and fragments of marble. And let Rick fill you in on the various aspects of the Colosseum and its place in Roman history.
Heading upstairs, Roman brick and concrete. While the Colosseum's exterior was built with big blocks of heavy travertine, the interior uses another great Roman invention, brick and concrete. They built hollow shells of brick, then filled them in with concrete made of cement and rubble. Brick shells filled with concrete could be shaped into pillars and arches to support the bleacher seats, which radiate out and up from the arena. The bare brick we see today was once faced with sheets of ornamental marble and decorative columns. A few marble seats have been restored. You can see them at the far east end of the arena. The Colosseum was built at Rome's peak, midway in its glorious history. Remember, Rome lasted 1,000 years, from 500 BC to 500 AD. It grew for 500 years, peaked for 200 years, and fell for 300 years. For the first half, Rome was a republic, ruled by elected senators, with an economy based on farming and trading wine and olive oil. The next 500 years, Rome was an empire, ruled by a dictator called the Caesar. Rome's wealth came from conquering and occupying foreign lands, which supplied Rome with booty, tribute, and slave labor. The Colosseum was built in imperial times as a grand venue for public spectacles sponsored by emperors and ambitious politicians. Admire the view from here in the cheap seats. The Colosseum was strictly segregated. Down at ringside, the emperor, senators, vestal virgins, and VIPs sat on marble seats with their names carved on them. The next level up was for those of noble birth. The level we're at was probably for ordinary free Roman citizens called plebeians. And up at the very top, 100 yards from the action, there were once wooden bleachers for the poorest people, for foreigners, slaves, and women. The top story of the Colosseum is mostly ruined, but some of it survives along the north side. This was not part of the original three-story structure, but was added around 230 AD after a fire. Picture the awning that could have been stretched across the top of the stadium. It was strung along horizontal beams that pointed inward toward the center. The awning only covered about a third of the stadium, so those at the top always enjoyed shade, while many nobles down below roasted in the sun.
By now, you should be at the west end of the upper level. Here you'll find a bookstore. Nearby, there are often temporary exhibits.
But we're here for the view.
So, find a spot in the open air where you can look west outside the Colosseum. You'll see several monuments nearby, including the big, white, triumphal arch of Constantine. From this viewpoint, look down on the hordes of tourists buzzing around the base of the Colosseum and picture them in togas.
The Colosseum surroundings. Along the southwest side of the Colosseum is the Arch of Constantine, which we'll talk about a bit later. Beyond the arch rises Palatine Hill, dotted with umbrella pines. The pedestrian roadway that leads west from the arch is the Via Sacra, or Sacred Way, once Rome's main street. It heads up an incline toward the Arch of Titus. You can just see the white top of that arch from here. That marks the start of the Forum, the religious, political, and commercial heart of ancient Rome. The Colosseum was built between three of Rome's legendary seven hills, the Palatine, the Esquiline to the north, and the Coelian to the south. The Colosseum was built on land where the notorious Emperor Nero once had his sumptuous golden house, with a colossal statue of himself standing at the front door. The house stretched from the Arch of Titus in the Forum across the valley where the Colosseum stands today, and up onto the Esquiline Hill. With the construction of this mammoth arena, Nero's statue became the Colosseum's 100-foot-tall doorman.
Look to the west in the direction of the Forum. Between the Colosseum and the Forum are some ruins sitting atop a raised, rectangular-shaped hill. You'll recognize the hill by some door-like openings cut into the hill's support wall. Atop the hill are ruins of a tall arched alcove made of brick. Behind the arch rises the church bell tower. The ruins are all that's left of the once great Temple of Venus and Rome.
The Temple of Venus and Rome. Rome's biggest temple once covered the entire hill. Along either side, to the left and right, you can still see some of the massive white columns, nearly 6 feet thick, that mark the perimeter of the temple complex. In its day, the temple was one of the most prominent in all Rome. The size of a football field and 100 feet tall, the Grand Temple sat on this raised platform for all Rome to see. It was a Greek-style temple surrounded by white columns and topped with a triangular pediment above the entrance. Now focus on the main ruin in the center, the tall brick alcove with the crosshatch ceiling. This was the cella, or sacred chamber of the temple. Under the arched ceiling at the center of the temple once sat a monumental statue of Venus, the goddess of love. Worshippers, especially newlyweds, would climb the steps to the entrance and make a sacrifice to ask Venus to bring them good luck. You can still see part of the staircase that led from the Colosseum up the hill and into the temple. The temple was designed by the 2nd century Emperor Hadrian, an amateur architect who also built the Pantheon. Hadrian's design was critiqued by Rome's best-known architect, who complained that the huge statues would have been so cramped they'd bump their heads if they stood up. Hadrian, who never took criticism very well, had the architect killed. Remember that this was the Temple of Venus and Rome. It was actually a double temple, home to two goddesses seated back to back. While Venus faced the Colosseum, another statue faced the Forum, the goddess named Roma Eterna. Paired together, Venus, the legendary ancestor of Romulus, and Roma Eterna, the personification of the city, symbolized both the birth and the eternal destiny of a race of people meant to endure forever. The goddesses' Latin names were written back to back in the twin cellas. On one side, Roma, and on the other, Amor. R-O-M-A? Flip the letters, A-M-O-R. Get it? It's a palindrome. The symmetry of their names reinforced that Rome and love were meant to go together. After the fall of Rome, a Christian church with a bell tower was built atop the ruins. These days, Roman newlyweds get married here to ensure themselves love and happiness for eternity.
Ah, now turn your attention to the Arch of Constantine, the big, white, triumphal arch to the southwest of the Colosseum.
The Arch of Constantine. If you are a Christian, were raised a Christian, or simply belong to a so-called Christian nation, ponder this arch. It marks one of the great turning points in history, the military coup that made Christianity mainstream. In the year 312, Emperor Constantine defeated his rival, Maxentius, in the crucial Battle of the Milvian Bridge. The night before, Constantine saw a vision of a cross in the sky. He attributed his victory to this vision. Constantine, whose mother and sister were Christians, became sole emperor and legalized Christianity. With this one battle, a once obscure Jewish sect with a handful of followers was now the state-sanctioned religion of the entire Western world. Think of it this way. In 300 AD, you could be killed for being a Christian. By 400 AD, you could be killed for not being a Christian. Church enrollment boomed. This newly restored arch is like an ancient museum. It's decorated entirely with recycled carvings originally made for other buildings. By covering it with exquisite carvings of High Roman art, works that glorified previous emperors, Constantine put himself in their league. 4th-century Rome may have been in decline, but Constantine clung to its glorious past.
With the coming of Christianity, the Colosseum's glory days were slowly approaching the end.
And so is this tour. But there's still more of the Colosseum to see. You can check out the temporary exhibits. There's also a small permanent exhibit located on the upper level, near the east end. If you haven't spent much time on the ground level yet, it offers still more spectacular views and close-ups of the arena's underground passageways.
Or start heading for the exit. It's downstairs, usually on the south side, near the Vestal Virgin's box. Wherever you may roam...
You got me.
Keep exploring while you listen to one final track. Let Rick bring the story of the Colosseum right up to the present day.
The Colosseum's 2,000-year legacy. With the coming of Christianity to Rome, the Colosseum and its deadly games slowly became politically incorrect. However, gladiator contests continued here sporadically until they were banned in 435. Animal hunts continued a few decades more. As Rome's empire dwindled and the infrastructure crumbled, the stadium itself was neglected. Finally, around 523, after nearly 500 years of games, the last animal was slaughtered, and the Colosseum shut its doors. For the next 1,000 years, the structure was inhabited by various squatters, used as makeshift apartments or shops, as a church, as a cemetery, or as a place of refuge during civil disturbances. Over time, the Colosseum was eroded by wind, rain, and the strain of gravity. A series of earthquakes weakened the structure, and a powerful quake in 1349 toppled the south side. More than anything, the Colosseum was dismantled by the Roman citizens themselves, who used it as a quarry throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. They carted off pre-cut stones to be reused for palaces and churches, including St. Peter's. Much of the marble was pulverized into mortar, and 300 tons of iron brackets were pried out and melted down, resulting in the pockmarking you see today. Finally, in the 16th century, a series of popes took pity on the pagan structure. They saw themselves as protectors of Rome's legacy and preservers of the memory of the Christians who may have been martyred here, whether true or not. They shored up the south and west sides with bricks and placed the big cross on the north side of the arena. Today, the Colosseum links Rome's past with its vital present. Major political demonstrations begin or end here, providing them an iconic backdrop for the TV cameras. On Good Fridays, the Pope comes here to lead pilgrims as they follow the Stations of the Cross. As the legend goes, so long as the Colosseum shall stand, the city of Rome shall stand as well. For nearly 2,000 years, the Colosseum has been the enduring symbol of Rome, the eternal city. We hope you enjoyed this walk through the Roman Colosseum. Thanks to Gene Openshaw, the co-author of this tour. If you're up for more sightseeing, the Roman Forum is just 100 yards away, and we have another audio tour available for that. We also have audio tours for the Pantheon, for St. Peter's, and for the Sistine Chapel. Remember, this tour was excerpted from the Rick Steves Rome Guidebook, co-authored with Gene Openshaw. For more details on eating, sleeping, and sightseeing in Rome, refer to this year's edition of that guidebook. For more free audio tours and podcasts, and for information about our guidebooks, TV shows, bus tours, and travel gear, visit our website at ricksteves.com. This tour was produced by Cedar House Audio Productions. Grazie.
Arrivederci.
And buon viaggio.